in Leavenworth, Washington, on February 5th, 1987, in Werner's home. Werner was Holden Village business manager from the fall of 1963 until the spring of 1984, right, Werner? About 20 plus years. And we are doing this tape for the Holden Village Oral History Project. Werner, it's good to be able to talk with you. Can you tell us how you began at the village? What was your first visit like, and when was that?
I suppose, like many other people, that I came up first out of curiosity. In 1961, they had publicized the village primarily in the Northwest, and were encouraging people to come up and take a look at what the Lutherans potentially would have as a retreat or a Bible camp. They really didn't even have a term for it, I think, at that time. Went up the last weekend in September of 1961 to attend the dedication of the diesel electric plants, and this was my first introduction to the village. There were about 30 people at the village at that time, including the guests that came in for the weekend, and also on the Sunday noon we came in. I think it was just Saturday to Sunday, basically, that we were there. On Sunday noon, I remember several people flew in. One of them was Vic Nelson.
By float plane. From Chelan.
Yeah, they were involved in some of the promotion of the village, and they wanted to talk to the people that were there for the weekend and encourage them to become involved in some of the volunteer committees in Seattle. And I spoke to Vic after their presentation that noon at dinner, and said that I was very interested in helping, and I, at the time, was an engineer at Boeing, and said that I would like to volunteer my time to help with some of the promotion and finance committees, which I proceeded to do, and from then on just became more and more interested and more involved in the village activities. I also was there in 1962, and I think that's when I first met Wes Preeb, was in the fall of 62. And then in 63, I came back as a volunteer worker. I applied to the Guild during the winter of 62, indicating that I was interested in a volunteer position.
Now, you were back in 62 summer?
In the summer of 62.
Doing some volunteer work?
No, in 62, I was a guest.
Okay. How long were you there, do you recall?
I think a week during that summer.
And you participated in some program that was being offered?
Yeah, it was... you know, a very, very minimal program. I think at the time it was, again, an overall interest in the area as far as the outdoors, hiking, as well as the program that was offered there, and it was pretty minimal in 62. 62 was the year that the World's Fair occurred in Seattle, and that was, looking back on it, I think one of the significant things for Holden, because so many people from the Midwest that were Lutheran came out to visit relatives in the Seattle area or in the West Coast. And there had been articles in, I think, a number of the church periodicals indicating that people should visit Holden on their way to the World's Fair, and they proceeded to do that. That summer, as I recall, in 62, the attendance went up to like 1,600 people.
Yes.
To 1,600, and primarily, again, because of the World's Fair, and most of those people that came out did so for a very short time, like a day or two.
Yes.
Just on their way either to or from the World's Fair. But it did generate a lot of exposure for the village, and I think at that point certainly got the word back to the Midwest. As I recall the figures, that the attendance then proceeded to climb after that point. And I think a lot of it was the early publicity as well as the exposure that the World's Fair gave in 1962.
So then you were back in 63, in the summer?
63. I started as a volunteer the 1st of June. And at that time, as I recall, there were only five of us that were on the permanent volunteer staff. It was a very small staff, and in those first several years, the youth offices of the three major Lutheran synods chose what they called work campers from the youth offices, and generally tried to get about 20 work campers each month, and each synod was responsible for one of the 3 months of the summer.
And then the five of you were there through the whole summer.
Whole summer. And we were considered the permanent staff, I guess, sort of supervisors of the others that would come.
And you did, among other things, food service, right?
I was, I think, listed as the food service manager or supervisor. And basically, I think that was helping with some of the ordering, but also making sure the dishes were washed.
Did you also cook?
No. Well,
you didn't do the cooking?
No, I didn't do any of the cooking. Now, Bertha Pearson was the cook at that time.
Oh, yes.
And a number of others, of course, would come in, and volunteers were assigned to help. But to tell you the truth, I don't even remember all my responsibilities were that summer.
So you served through the end of August,
right,
in that capacity?
Yeah, I was on a leave of absence from Boeing. In the spring of 63, I applied to my supervisor at Boeing for a leave of absence, which it was granted primarily because we were in between programs, and then I was scheduled to return to Boeing September 1st of that fall.
And you did return?
Right.
And what came next then in your history with the village?
Well, in either the end of, I think it was toward the end of September that I got a call from Vern Rieke, and the trustees were meeting in Seattle at the time with Carol, and he wanted to know if I would consider the position of business manager that he said that Carol had chosen me to work with him, if I was, you know, willing and interested in doing that. And Carol had mentioned this, of course, earlier during the summer when we were together, or in late summer. And at the time, I thought that was, there would be no question that I definitely would take it if it was offered me, because I loved the village very much and was excited about the possibility. But then when the offer was made and some other possibilities came up with Boeing, it was a rather difficult decision to make. But I did decide to quit my job at Boeing and accept the position with Holden, which then I started on November 22nd in 1963.
Which, of course, was the day that President Kennedy was assassinated.
Right.
And you were working then in Seattle,
right,
in an office in Seattle.
Yeah, at that time there was no activity at the village during the winter time, so it worked on a schedule of soon after Labor Day, or maybe by October 1st, the office was moved from Holden back to Seattle, and at that time it was located in the second story of Gilberg's fuel oil business.
Gil, at the time, for those who don't know that name, was the interim director of the village. I think that's what they called him at that point.
Well, at that point that I started, then he had...
By that time, Carol Hinterly was the director.
He had no official capacity. He was...
Gil earlier had been the interim director
and manager.
Yes.
As a volunteer.
But he was still providing space for the office in his facility in
right.
Seattle.
Right.
Where was that located? In Seattle.
It was in Ballard. I think, if I remember the address, it was 5616. I really don't remember the address. I think 5616.
But in the Ballard community of Seattle.
In the Ballard community.
Okay.
Just, I think, two blocks off of Market Street, which is the main... The offices were there for a couple of years, and then about the 15th of May, we would move back to the village, take most of the files, the typewriter and so forth that we had there, and we would move back to the village. And after a couple of years, we moved the office down to a building that was owned by Gethsemane Lutheran Church that was on Terry Avenue, right behind Gethsemane Lutheran, and then the office stayed there until the permanent move to the village in the summer of 1966.
So you went to Gethsemane Lutheran in Seattle from sometime in the early 60s, 64
yeah,
or so until 66?
Yeah, it had been probably 64. I think the office was there like 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You began with people really trying to put together the village. You were still working on renovation in 63-64, I'm sure, getting the buildings, which were basically in good condition but needed some repair and upgrading. You were still working at that those early years. You were still working with the infrastructure for the village. Talk a little bit about that. What were the major problems? You had an electrical system in place, but
The buildings were basically sound as far as the structure. The heating systems in most of the buildings were not operating. In fact, in even the summer of 1963 that I was there, no buildings had heat. Most of the people in the mornings when it was cold, and it was an exceptionally cold, wet summer of 1963, they would come into the dining hall, because at that time the big stoves for cooking in the dining hall were all fired stoves. And Reuben would get up 5:30 in the morning, and Reuben Thompson, and he would start those big stoves so that they would warm up by the time it was time to start cooking breakfast. And they put out an awful lot of heat, and so people would gather in the dining room, just as about the only warm place. There was no hot water in most of the buildings, so the guests coming up would have running cold water in the rooms, but no running hot water in the rooms. So in a sense, the village was really quite primitive, and people that would come there, did so because they were excited about potentially what the village was, but certainly they didn't come there because of any comfort that the village could provide. It was a camping experience inside.
Yes.
And so in the summer of 1963, we started renovating, as far as heating systems, a lot of the for the hot water in building, heating systems in building. Lodge 4 had not been activated at all at that time. In fact, I think it was later, in 1964 maybe, that Lodge 4 was used for the first time. It had not been painted or cleaned up, or water system hadn't been activated. So all of those type of things were improved, and we did the improvements sort of building by building as priorities would arise. Even the gymnasium, or now the village center, there was no heat in that building for a number of years. And again, the summer of 1963, that was exceptionally cold, when the theater group from Augsburg College in Minneapolis came out, that in the evening when we had drama, everybody would bring their sleeping bags or blankets and would sit in the gym trying to stay warm, just to and I remember also the people that were the students that came out from Oxford would dress in their big winter coats during their practice times during the day, because it was so cold in there. And
this was summer,
yeah, the summer of 63.
Yes.
And I don't, in the 20 years that I was there, there was never a summer like that again. But it, anybody who was there at that time remembered the summer of 63, and it really did bring about the beginning of the design of Koinonia, because there was no place in the village for people just to gather, like around the fireplace, to get warm and to sit for conversation. And it was really like the village wasn't designed for transient people. The village was designed as a community for permanent people, and they always had their rooms to go to. But when the village became Holden Retreat Center Village, there was a place needed where people could gather, like a hotel lobby, for conversation, for warming up. And so it was at that time that Koinonia was really conceived, and the design was started. I don't know if we want to talk about that, maybe.
You could just summarize that. As I recall, Koinonia was done over a period of a couple years, from about 64 to 66, wasn't it, before it was finished?
Right, yeah. The first section was more or less completed in the summer of 66, and the whole back section with the rooms upstairs and the library downstairs was not completed until 67, maybe 68.
And then, of course, there was an addition done in the early 80s.
Right, yeah.
That's quite recent.
Where, yeah, where the dining hall now, for the winter dining hall, then that was done in the, much later. But the originally, the design for Koinonia included the original museum of the village was going to be in Koinonia and was in Koinonia for a number of years, but it didn't really work out because it was a multi-purpose room as well as museum, mm-hmm. so that the displays that Rudy would put up would be taken down because it was also used as a schoolroom, a meeting room. You know, some displays would disappear or, you know, get damaged, and so that the original intent of the museum in Koinonia didn't work out because it was a multi-purpose building.
Yeah. And I think that's where the lending library is now. It was in that side of Koinonia, isn't it?
Right, yeah, where the museum was.
Yeah,
where the lending library. And the other side, where the reference library, that was always listed in the plans as a library. And the section that's now the dishwashing area for the new kitchen in Koinonia, that was the original kitchen of Koinonia. And Koinonia was conceived also even starting in 63, 64, when the design was worked on. It was, Koinonia was conceived as a potential winter program building, so it had its own kitchen. It was a very small kitchen, but and Koinonia was then the first winter sort of activity program building, with the rooms upstairs, a small kitchen. When we used Koinonia for the dining room as well as the kitchen, the area around the fireplace was the dining room, and we would have tables that we would put up at mealtime and take them down then after meals, so that it could be used as the multi-purpose room and program room. And I think we had as many as probably 70, 80 people that were there some of the winters that ate in Koinonia and lived there. And again, it was the first program building. The upstairs rooms were rushed to be completed because Dr. Bainton was coming, and I think that was in 68 that he came the first time.
And Roland Bainton, church history professor at Yale, mm-hmm. I believe,
right.
He was then, and a Quaker who was also a student of Martin Luther.
And it was a rather important occasion when he accepted the invitation to come to Holden, and we wanted him to have nice quarters, and we were working on Koinonia, and so it was a motivation to get the rooms upstairs in Koinonia completed so that he could have one of the new rooms when he arrived. And then actually the library moved into Koinonia about the same time, and Dr. Bainton was involved in the dedication of the library along with Mary
Henderly. Werner, the preparation of the buildings for the village as we now know it, with an ability to operate with 400 people or more in the summertime, that must have taken several years to complete. By about what year would you say that the basic readying of all the buildings was finished, the first time through? There's been further remodeling since, but all the buildings basically up to where they could be used to have guests in the village, roughly as we now know it. When was that completed?
Well, I think quite early, really, in 60, I think even in 66, that all the buildings were basically usable except the back part of Koinonia. Other than that, all the buildings had been activated as far as being painted inside the first time, been basically cleaned up, the electrical systems activated, the water systems, hot water. All of that, I think, was pretty well completed by 66. And then from there on, we continued to make improvements as money was available and as experience taught us what type of remodeling would be most effective in that
yes.
situation.
All right, take us now into the evolving of a winter village. Originally, through the winter, there was one person, and then later, I think, two people who stayed there as watchmen, as sort of guards or monitors through the winter. Reuben Thompson did that the first couple of winters, I believe, and then with his dog, Bugger.
Right.
And then later, another person stayed with him. When did it grow beyond that?
Not until 1966.
The winter of 66-67?
Right.
That would be?
Right. It was... I think it was the board meeting probably would have been in 1965 in the fall, or it might have been the executive committee after that that gave the approval to buy the first snowmobile, because that was the really the first thing that was needed to get transportation up there. Bill Peel and his wife Louise gave the first snow vehicle to the village, and that was in 1964. And Bill and Louise and I delivered it to the village in, I think it was February of 1964, unloading it from the bow of the speedway. And I had rented a toboggan from REI in Seattle, so we would have some luggage space to haul some things up. And this was in the days when recreational snowmobiling was almost non-existent. In fact, there was only one dealer in Seattle that even carried snowmobiles, and it was a Bombardier, the Skidoo, and the Peels donated it to the village so that Reuben would have some better access than skiing, just for safety. So that was when really the first snowmobile was delivered to the village, but it was a small recreational snowmobile that would be okay for one or two people. And we found out that those snowmobiles just weren't adequate up there because of the heavy, deep powder snow. But it certainly did a great job for the one or two people that were initially in the village. By 66, then, it was clear if we were going to open the village that transportation was going to be one of the major things. It was felt that other than that, the village was operable, certainly in the winter time. By that time, the first leg of the hydro was completed, and so we had hydroelectric energy and wouldn't have to rely on diesel fuel. So we knew that we had electrical energy that would be used, although the hydro plants had never been left running in the winter, so that there was some question as how much power they would put out, if there would be problems with freezing up. And that was a whole new learning sequence of how to operate the hydro plant in the winter time and the problems associated with it. Heat was initially Chalet 1 was worked on for the initial building in the winter time, and a wood stove was installed. Of course, wood was cut for that first winter. Most of our supplies were brought up in the fall. We didn't really get any fresh supplies in the winter. Looking back on it, you know, I'm not sure why we didn't, but we somehow thought that it would be too difficult to get them or to store them. We did have a freezer that we stored meat in, but like the eggs, we got eggs fresh in October, and we used the last of them in May. The older they got, we just didn't use them for fried eggs.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any fresh milk. Now, why we didn't have fresh milk sent up, I really am not sure. I guess we just figured...
Because you could have.
Oh, yeah, we could have. But I think we figured it would be too expensive. I'm not sure, but the only milk we used that winter was dried milk. When a few guests would come up, we would always ask them to bring a head of lettuce or some fresh vegetable, because that was things that we would dream of.
Now, there was no program offered early during the winter. There were how many lived there, and what did guests do when they came?
Well, there were just three of us really that lived there the entire winter. Myself, Judy, and Terry Saturn, and then Joe Walmer was the one person that was like the mechanic, the carpenter, the plumber, all of those things rolled into one terrific person, and that was Joe. And now he didn't spend the entire winter. He and his wife lived in Colville, and he went back and forth, but he was basically there a good deal of the winter.
Joe, what's his last name?
Walmer.
Walmer.
And, but oftentimes there were just three of us in the village, and even though there was no program as such, we we maintained the worship life of the village. We had our vespers each day and matin. Judy did really all the cooking, or most of the cooking, but we started sort of a tradition at that time, at least in the early years of the winter, that I guess it was a very sexist thing, but the women did the cooking and the men did the dishes.
Mm-hmm.
And that just seemed to work out that way. We met the boat with the snowmobile three or four times a week, depending on the schedule. We had installed communications. We had gotten a radio that was hooked into the sheriff's department through Stehekin. We got permission from the sheriff's department to have a radio on their frequency for emergencies. So that did give us some radio coverage as long as we could reach Stehekin, and then Stehekin could reach Wenatchee. And so any emergency messages we had or needed to transmit, we could do through Stehekin.
Did you stay there through the winter, partly to see if it could be done, and did you also have a work program that winter?
I guess a lot of it was just to see once if it was feasible to keep the village open, you know, for the purpose of Holden's activities,
mm-hmm.
On a year-round basis. Primarily, were the facilities, usable? Was it reasonable to consider people coming up? How dangerous was it? Was transportation, by snowmobile going to be feasible?
Mm-hmm.
What dangers of, avalanche, various other things, would we, encounter in terms of guests coming up? A few guests did come up that winter. In fact, Howard and Loretta Gilling started their tradition of being there, I think, every year for Christmas until I think last year was the first year they weren't there for Christmas. They came up the week before Christmas, and just the two of them, Howard and Loretta, and I think they also started the tradition of bringing presents to the village, such as the cookies that Loretta always baked. And that's when we first got acquainted with Howard and Loretta, which then evolved into a very deep friendship, and Howard and Loretta becoming very much a part of Holden year-round, but always there in the wintertime.
And they came that first 66 winter,
right,
or that 66
yeah.
Christmas.
Yeah. And then I think there might have been 15 or 20 people total that came up sometime during the winter. And everybody that came had to live in Chalet 1. That was the only building that was open. The first two winters, by the second winter, then we decided to open up Chalet 2. That was, we needed the extra space. We were going to have a few more staff in the village, and that was a logical one to consider opening. And then from there on, each winter grew both in terms of staff, in terms of number of guests coming in, and also in terms of scheduled work that needed to be done. The first winter there was work, but there wasn't a lot, I don't think, accomplished. We, of course, operated the office up there year-round. And then a lot of, with that few number of people, a lot of it was just, maintaining life in the village. Remoteness is nice, but also when you don't have some of the conveniences, you're spending a lot of time just living.
Yes.
And just keeping the building warm. We didn't have running water all the time in the building, and we did keep the water system on, and it worked most of that winter. Things like this, it was amazing at how much time it just took to maintain life. And of course in the main part of the winter it was dark by 4 o'clock, and then other buildings that really didn't have any heat or electricity, nothing could be done in there. So
when did the winter program begin to evolve?
I suppose really right at that point, because as I say, we did have, the worship life of the village continued on through the winter as soon as it opened. And then each year, as more people came up, we try to plan some program opportunities.
What sorts of things do you recall?
Well, I know one of the first things that we did was requested a small budget for movies, because we didn't, of course, have television up there or other entertainment, and we sort of started the tradition of movie night at the village very, very early. That was an easy program, to import. And and then as soon as sabbatical families started coming to the village, well, that in a sense opened up the possibility of that faculty person that was on sabbatical then also becoming, program potential. And so that each year that occurred, then it just opened up more and more possibilities for program to evolve.
And then more formally, there was program beginning with about, was it 72, 73, the lifestyle enrichment?
Right, yeah, that was probably the first formal winter program in, I guess that was maybe the next evolvement of program at the village, because even in 1970 we had, I think, three or four people on sabbatical in 1970. And so we had, in a sense, a lot of program, but it wasn't advertised in the sense that the lifestyle program was. And the early program, of course, involved the entire village more so than the lifestyle program that specifically invited students in for a discipline of study.
People who registered specifically
right.
for that.
Right.
When did the first offering of a school, a public school, come, do you recall?
Well, that came as a result of the group home program.
All right, tell us about the group home program first, then.
And I'm not sure that I can remember dates, but
I believe that was 1970 or thereabouts.
Yeah, it was.
That
I was going to say 69 to 70. It really came about by the state contacting us and asking us if, or asking Holden if we would be interested in having a small group home. A judge from Eastern Washington that was a Lutheran and that had known about Holden and that also dealt a lot with the Department of Social and Health Services really made the suggestion, and there was a small group of people from the state, including this judge, that came to the village and talked to us and to look over the village to see if they thought it was at all usable. And their intent was that since there was already a community at Holden, that it would be possible to have a very small group home, smaller than what would be financially feasible for somebody independently doing on their own outside of the village context. And we agreed then to give it a try. And it was a help because it did provide income to the village. We were paid on the basis of so much per boy that was there. We were limited to six boys, ages 14 to 17.
And these were boys who were under the care of the court systems?
Yeah, most of them
juvenile were justice systems?
Yeah, most of them were dependency situations where, for one reason or another, they could no longer live at home, and so that they became wards of the court. And then we're placed in a group home such as Holden. And we had some more serious problems over the years as far as boys that had been into more serious trouble. It was a unique opportunity for the village, but it was also one of those that got us sort of tangled up into more of the bureaucracy of the rules and regulations of the state, because they such things as fire safety. We had to designate a building that the group home boys would stay in, and that building had to be upgraded to meet the fire safety, the health standards, all of the what appeared at that time and probably is petty state regulations, even plastic mattress covers on the beds and on the pillows, and things that we wouldn't normally do in the village became an exception because of the group home. Now, we were reimbursed for a lot of that, but it did become a problem because the village wasn't used to running with so many regulations and rules, and I think that was one of the reasons that the group home did, I think, quite well for some of the boys. We still meet them in Wenatchee every once in a while, some of the boys that were up there, and that turned out very well.
It helped them.
Yeah, I think, and I always looked upon it as that the program of the village wasn't so great. I don't think it was necessarily the religious input or anything else. I guess I came to the conclusion after the group home quit that the greatest thing that we offered these boys was a year or 9 months away from harassment by the legal system, and also it gave them an opportunity to see a lifestyle that they had never been able to observe before in terms of community, people caring for each other, family life, and so it gave them an option that they had never been exposed to.
And see, I think, another way, a supportive community.
Right, yeah, and rather than be in a community that always blamed them for everything. And in many ways, the village was a bad place because it was so open. Many of the boys had problems with stealing, and it was just a heyday at the village because everything was open.
Yes.
And every once in a while, we would go to the boys' rooms and collect everything from the store that they had taken, you know, that they didn't need, but that it was just easy to take, so they took it.
Yeah. You know?
And not all of them, but... the other thing that was interesting, I thought, about the group home was that one of the biggest problems was discipline, because there was really nothing in the village that we could discipline the boys to do that all of the rest of us weren't doing anyway, and it's pretty hard to say that to discipline if I'm doing it too or the other volunteers were doing it. Like, you couldn't say, well, okay, you have to do dishes tonight because everybody was doing dishes.
Or, yes.
You couldn't split wood, or you have to split wood because everybody was splitting wood. And so how do you discipline?
Hard to find a punishment.
Yeah, yeah. And
how many years did the group home continue?
I think it continued then until like 78, 77 or 78. And
and was ended, I believe, because there was a new state requirement that a psychiatrist be in residence.
Well, I don't think it was a psychiatrist. It was
a psychologist.
It had to be someone with a master's degree in counseling.
Uh-huh.
Had to work with the boys so many times a week.
Okay.
And
but a professionally trained counselor had to be there.
Yeah, and it was impractical. It wasn't possible for the village to hire somebody. John Schramm was the director at that time and really had worked in this capacity before he came to the village, I think when he was with Lutheran Social Services in Washington, D.C., and certainly had the qualifications to do it, but didn't have the specific degree that the state said that was needed. And so if John could have fulfilled that, I mean, we were doing the counseling there with very qualified people. It was just that we didn't meet the specific requirement, and it wasn't practical. And so it just necessitated that the village get out of the program. And some thought had been given to that too, because there was always disruptive situations, and the question, you know, would come up, well, you know, are we in the business of a group home or are we in the business of a retreat center? And you know, like in the first years of the group home, we had boys there year round during the summer and winter, and the summer proved to be a very difficult time to operate the program because of the amount of activity, you know, the disruption that would be caused if there were problems with some of the boys. And there was always that tension of, you know, what are we here for? And the board frequently discussed this and never decided. I mean, I think there was a real hesitance to say, you know, no, we don't want to have it, because that's sort of like saying that the church shouldn't be involved in the social ministry.
Yes.
So I think there was a hesitancy to say no to it, but when this new regulation finally occurred, it was a convenient, you know, time to say, you know, we can no longer have a group home here. So.
Now, the public school with Chelan, as part of the Chelan school district, that began with the coming of the group home?
Yeah, because the state would require that schooling would be offered to the boys. And so I worked with the superintendent of schools in Chelan to see what we could do to arrange some type of a school system at Holden. And we initially tried to do it on a volunteer basis, so that we knew that there were plenty of school teachers that would volunteer their time to come up in the winter, and we'd already had people apply for it. And that really is how the school got started. We had a teacher that would come just on the volunteer staff that would be the teacher and would run a curriculum really with through the auspices of Chelan. And any completion of coursework that would be done would then be given as credit through Chelan. About 2 years later, a new superintendent came to the Chelan area, and I think also then we were getting a few more boys in the group home, and it was decided that some formal system would have to be worked out, that legally, I think because of like the teachers union in the state, the association, that they knew that there was problems if we had a volunteer teacher at the village.
Yes.
And so it was again sort of regulations that dictated that a formal agreement would have to be worked out with the school system, which then proceeded to be done, so that Holden was considered an extension of the Chelan school district. And
with a K through 12 program?
With a K through 12 program. It was really necessitated because of the group home boys that it would be, you know, at least 9 through 12. But at the time, then there were more, like in 1970, I think one of those early years, we even had 20-some students in the school because of sabbatical families that were there. And
children of staff?
And children of staff, and then group home boys, so that it was a, you know, a fairly large school compared with what we've had in recent years.
So it reached its peak at about the mid-20s, you recall?
Yeah, and I think that was maybe only for 1 year that we might have had 22, 23 in the school system.
And currently it runs more like 8 or 10?
Yeah, it's been, you know, I think as low as 4, and probably the average in the last few years has been 8 or 10. But the Chelan School District then is responsible for hiring two teachers, one for the elementary and one for the secondary.
Yes. The formation of the congregation at Holden Village, Fullness of God Lutheran Church, that began about when and for what reasons was it formed?
It was in the early 70s that it began. I don't remember the exact date. Dr. Solberg worked with Holden on, Dr. Solberg was the bishop of the North Pacific District.
Of the ALC, the American Lutheran Church.
Right. And the reason that it was formed was that right from the beginning of Holden, well, communion, Eucharist was a very big part of the worship life of the village. Only there was no authority, because there was no congregation at the village,
yes,
you know, to sanction communion officially, which the church requires. And so that it was always done through the sanctioning of the Lake Chelan Lutheran Church in Chelan, which was 40 miles away. So those of us who then became more or less a permanent part of the village starting in 1966 had membership in the Chelan congregation. Carol and Mary were members down there. We were members. A number of people that moved to the village, you know, on a longer term basis became members of the Lake Chelan Community Church, but there was no practical way to ever worship with that community. And so Carol was anxious that especially those of us that were there on a more or less a year-round basis could be an active part of a congregation, and not only that, you know, to take part in the Eucharist, but to take part in the worship life and have the fellowship and support of a congregation. So that really was the basis for the beginning of the congregation. Dr. Solberg came up a number of times to talk with people at the village, to work out the constitution. And Dr. Solberg came up and was very helpful in working out the details. The original hope was that the congregation could really be listed as all three major synods, so that it wouldn't be
Missouri,
just,
LCA, and ALC.
And because all three of the synods were involved in the village, and there was no attempt to, or there was a hope that it wouldn't have to be just one synod, but in checking through all of the rules and regulations, there was just no way that could be done. And so finally, I assume because Carol was ALC clergy, and maybe that was the primary reason, but we happened to be ALC, and so it did get to be an ALC congregation. And
still is.
And still is, yeah.
And as I recall, it was also hoped that through forming a congregation, there could be some way of relating the village community to the larger church's mission.
Right.
Through financial support, which
yeah.
has been done.
Right. In fact, it was one of the unique things. It's probably one of the only congregations in the church that pledges 100% of its income to benevolence.
To benevolence, yes, yes.
And that was always one of the fun things that usually in the first part of January of each year, the congregation would meet to give away all its money. The congregation
yes.
had no expense. Carol was called as the pastor of the congregation, but of course was under no salary from the congregation. There was no other expense that the congregation had. Even communion wine was, of course, purchased by the village, since most of the communicants were village guests and not the congregation. But the congregation was responsible for, the communion, sanctioning the communion. They were responsible for baptisms. That was another thing that sort of prompted the congregation. A number of baptisms had come up at the village, and you know, how, under what auspices do you baptize a child? So really all of the functions of a regular congregation were carried out there, at least all of the religious functions. We didn't have committees, although we sort of in a humorous way had Dorcas Circle and a few other things. They were it was the women would socially get together, but it would call it Ladies Aid or Dorcas Circle.
Yes.
And I can't remember if there was ever a men's group, but and then the congregational picnic. That was the big event of the year. We would, as a congregation, would go down to Lucerne in the summer and would go water skiing or swimming and even that. The potential, even on a year-round basis, that the congregation could become almost a divisive thing, and more so than, you know, would certainly be experienced in a normal community. But I think it was, you know, over the history of the village was always very well handled. It did eliminate some of the specific fellowship things that congregations might normally do as a single unit, but it was living and learning what could be adapted to that situation.
Werner, talk about the relationships with the Forest Service. You, for many years, maybe the whole time you were there, were the primary liaison person to the U.S. government, which meant the Forest Service. The village is there as a guest of the Forest Service, which really means a guest of the U.S. taxpayers.
That's right.
What does that mean? What problems? Advantages were there in that? What was the relationship like? Was it good, basically?
The village itself was, in other words, where the buildings existed, was approximately 20 acres, and that was under a special use permit from the Forest Service, and that basically meant that we were renting that land from the U.S. government for operation of a specific purpose. The contract, which was rather lengthy, was all a protection of the government. It gave us no protection. In one way, they could have released us or
terminated the permit
at any time. They would have had to have some reason to do it, but they could have done it. I think that as long as they could have, I think the phrase they show a higher purpose for the land, which means that in terms of all the other people in the country, if there was a higher purpose for that land, then they could terminate our contract, and that really still exists. So we were renters from the government, and this had some advantages and disadvantages. We naturally, as renters, had to hold to rules, and any any federal rule also included any county or state rules. So we were under all of the regulations of the Washington State, Chelan County, and the federal government. The Forest Service had the obligation as owners of the property that they had to make sure that we were complying to these regulations, and so that they came up for inspections. I guess I always found and always enjoyed very much working with the Forest Service. I appreciated the position that they were in. I accepted the fact that we were there because they owned the land and allowed us to be there, and really looked upon the Forest Service as the people that were helping us maintain the village. In a sense, they were our building inspectors, but we weren't paying them anything. So I guess from my standpoint, if I looked upon it in that sense, that we were getting a free service from them, then it didn't seem like an intrusion.
So they were good landlords to have. They are good landlords to have, and they are apparently to this day in sympathy with what the village is trying to do there.
Yeah, very much so. I think that they, when the mine closed down in 1957, of course it was a big economic disaster for the local area, including the Forest Service, because they were getting money back from the mine.
In what way?
Any activity such as the village itself was again under special use permit from the Forest Service. The tailings were on Forest Service property, and therefore the mine had to pay the Forest Service for the rental of the space where the tailings were on, and the Winston camp was on Forest Service property. So, and then I assume that there any part of the mine that may have been on forest property that wasn't patented land, there probably was some royalty going back to the government, although I am not positive about that. But basically, yeah, that when I first went up there in 63 as manager, there had been some conflict with the Forest Service, primarily because I think some trails that had been built up on Martin's Ridge, and it was right from the beginning it was very apparent that in order to work or get along with the Forest Service, that one thing you wanted to do is make sure that you didn't cross the Forest Service. I found the Forest Service always to be very tolerant, very supportive, and very helpful. But if there was any indication by the Forest Service that you were trying to get away with something, then all of a sudden the tolerance policy ceased to exist. And I always felt that all of the government agencies operated on a tolerance policy and could have shut us down at any moment for a wide variety of things. And I think that's true with any organization that is under these regulations. But they were very sympathetic with what the village was doing, the purpose of the village, and even the fact that the mine, the former mine facility, was now being used for some positive purpose. Because if Holden wouldn't have been there, it would have been very likely that the Forest Service would have ended up with the cost of removal of all the buildings and the cleaning up of the entire area, which would have been a big financial problem for them. So in that sense, we were helping them. It was also the forest supervisor in Wenatchee at that time, who I don't remember his name. As he went around the state, the Forest Service did more sort of promoting of areas at that time, and he was, as he would give speeches around the state, he would take slides of Holden and Holden Village and use it as an example of you know, how government property can be put to beneficial use for all people in the country. And later on, the Forest Service put out a publication that stated Holden Village is one of the prime examples of how a facility on public land has been rejuvenated and used for the public good and benefit. And I think the Holden facility and a facility in Montana were featured in this publication as two prime examples of properties that had been taken over by private interests, but done in such a way that they opened up new possibilities for public participation.
Sure. Serving the common good.
Right, yeah.
And in terms of recreation, using the wilderness area, which the Forest Service does want to promote, doing some environmental education, mm-hmm. I think in many years, maybe all years, the village has used Forest Service personnel as teachers at times. They would come into the village and offer a session.
Yeah, that was more in recent years that occurred, but the Forest Service always offered, and a number of times I can remember that they said that if your program people want faculty that we can help supply, we would be more than happy to send people up there, like for a few days or even a week, and in, you know, certain topics that they might be able to help with. So I think a lot of people have seen a conflict between Holden and the Forest Service, and I don't think the Forest Service ever looked upon that. In other words, that because we were associated with the Lutheran Church, that didn't make us any different from anybody else. As the district ranger often says, you know, don't forget, you know, the people coming to Holden, even though the majority may be Lutheran, they're still our public. And
yes.
So that, you know,
U.S. taxpayers.
That's right, yeah. And so I think that was always an important point, that sometimes we would become sensitive on the point, but the Forest Service would then turn around and remind us that, you know, no matter, you know, who we were or what we were doing, we were still part of the public that the Forest Service has an obligation to serve. And we could not, I mean, according to the rules of the special use permit, we cannot make it exclusively Lutheran.
Yes.
We can't exclude people, which the village has never tried to do. We can give first, in other words, if we have a group coming up there, if the village is full with a group or with individuals, we're not obligated to take people that register at random. In other words, the Forest Service isn't telling us that we have to do something outside of our planned program activity. As long as in the program material we recognize that anyone can register for any of the programs, then there's no difficulty. So I think the as I say, I always enjoyed working with the Forest Service, and during the time I was there, I thought we had excellent relationships with the Forest Service, because we did sort of look upon it as a mutual benefit to each of us, and I respected what they had to say. The one thing that I learned quite early in some of those inspections is that you have to divide out what any of the government agencies say as a personal suggestion and what they say as an official requirement.
Yes.
And as soon as that became clear, well, then I think it solved a lot of the problems, so that let's say the fire inspector came up and made some personal comment, you know, I would clarify, is that official or unofficial? And because anything official we would have to do, and we could be held liable and responsible if we didn't do it. A personal suggestion, you know, didn't have to be done. We could thank them for the suggestion, but we weren't required to implement it.
From about 1977 through 1981, I believe it was, there was a serious exploration of a way of using the Lucerne property, the Lucerne Resort property down on the lakeshore, 11 miles away from the village, under village sponsorship to do something. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why it ultimately did not happen?
The Lucerne property is also Forest Service property. It's been a resort on special use permit for many, many years. Originally, actually, as a bedroom community, or at one point as a bedroom community for the mine. Even before that, Lucerne was an important resort on the lake, and in the early years was really more important than Stehekin. People used to primarily get off at Lucerne, and only a few would go up to Stehekin. And then by the time the mine closed down, it had really reversed, so most of the activity was, tourist activity was in Stehekin and not at Lucerne. So Lucerne has had a very long history on the lake. It went through a series of owners during the time that Holden has been there, and never was able to really, I think, have the capital that was necessary to improve Lucerne to where it would attract the tourist people. Finally, in about 1976, the owner at that time, I can't recall his name right offhand. It was a Missouri Lutheran from the Seattle area. Very much a friend of the village over the years. It contributed a lot to the village. was the owner, and because of some conflict down there in terms of the legal ownership, a number of things had been done as the property had changed hands down there, the resort, but a lot of it was not really legally done, so it was really a mess from a legal ownership standpoint. And because he liked the village, and also because it was maybe an easy solution to the problem, that he just gave his interest, whatever that was, to Holden. In other words, Holden became the legal owner of the resort. Now, that could have been contested in court because, you know, nobody knew exactly what Mike owned, but we did end up with the ownership. The Forest Service was satisfied that we owned it, and therefore we operated it really as a resort for a number of years as we were going through the planning stage of putting something down at Lucerne that would be complementary to Holden's program, but also that would tend to serve the general populace more than Holden could, primarily because of location. So we began a very extensive development program, a planning development program down at Lucerne that lasted over several years, and working with the Forest Service, working with a number of architects and engineering friends on the science committee and in the area, and coming up with a plan that I thought was rather exciting, that would utilize a small permanent community at Lucerne, primarily involved with the arts and the crafts, so that the facility would include studios for potters, weavers, photographers, woodworkers, any of the arts and crafts, you know, could be involved down there. The people that would be a part of that community that would be working in these disciplines would also then be the operators of the resort, which would cater to people coming up lake for vacations, for hunting, for fishing, and that would provide the income for the community, so that it would really be, in a sense, self-supporting. It would also give an exposure to the artists that would be involved down there. We had talked about that there might be an average length of 3 years for an artist to be there, so that they would have long enough to establish themselves. They would have adequate time to sharpen their own skills, and also to have exposure to the public. So hopefully after 3 years they could move out then as an artist or a craftsman and move into the commercial world and you know, make it on their own. Lucerne would have a store, a library. The museum was planned, the mine museum was planned for Lucerne rather than Holden, because it was felt that there would again be more exposure to the public. Lucerne itself had a history of mining. There would be cottages for rental. There would be a small restaurant that was going to utilize a lot of homegrown things. We had looked extensively into an aquaculture program that would be take part in Lake Chelan.
Fish farming,
so that within screen pens in the lake, trout would be raised, and then that would be one of the main menus at the restaurant, as well as, you know, for the little community that would exist there. It would also be an example of a technology that people could learn about. And all of the things that were planned at Lucerne, and the science committee was very much involved in this, would not only become functional for the community and for the resort, but then would be a learning experience for the people. That was going to be true with the aquaculture program, the hydro plant that was down there. All of these things would be used as an educational opportunity as well as a functional activity for the resort. The plan eventually was turned down by the Forest Service, and we had total support of the local people in Chelan and Wenatchee, and some support out of Portland, where it was finally decided. But I think that what it amounted to is that Portland really never did trust Holden to be able to carry this off, and they thought that it was too ambitious. There were some very conservative people that apparently were part of the decision-making process in Portland. I think there might have even been some concern that that Holden was, quote, religious or Lutheran, and whether we had any basis for putting together something that would serve the public at Lucerne. I think all of these things came into that eventual decision, and there was a lot of support for Holden doing this, even from the business community in Chelan, because they knew that for their own welfare in Chelan, they need more activities up lake for tourists to enjoy. And
yes.
Lucerne had never really provided this, and I remember going down to Chelan when a special meeting was called by the business community, and to try to show their support to the Forest Service, and the Forest Service attended that and really were in full agreement with. I mean, they were very supportive of the project, but it was finally turned down in the Portland office. And even one of the problems could have been that the second in command in Portland Forest Service office at the time was a very active LCA layman, and I think that it made the decision more difficult and could have resulted in swaying it to the being turned down, because he didn't want to get caught in.
He wanted to avoid a conflict
right,
of interest.
Yeah, and so I think we talked to him a number of times, and even though he was supportive of it, I think that if it was even as far as the decision, he probably voted against it so that he couldn't be criticized for for being biased in the decision. And
what has happened since with that property?
Well, then according to again the special use permit that we had for the facilities, is that everything would have to be removed and the property returned to its original condition, and that's true in any special use permit. And so in the preceding years then, I think in about 2 years, all of the buildings were removed, foundations were bulldozed, a lot was hauled out down lake as far as some materials. The lot was hauled up to the tailings pile and buried, so that basically Holden then had the obligation of cleaning everything up and returning it to basically
to wilderness.
Wilderness, yeah. And
but does Holden still own hold a special use permit for that land?
No. The only thing that Holden holds right now, and I'm not even sure that that's current, is that we maintain the water permit for the hydro plant down there, because the water permits in the mid-70s especially were almost like mining permits, that people were taking these out in speculation of potential hydro development in various parts of the Northwest. And so that what we were paying, as I recall, like $6 a year for the water permit, we maintained that at least the times that I was up there. And again, I'm not sure if they've kept this up or not. So.
But Holden then has no interest at Lucerne any longer except for the dock.
The dock is not, we have no control over the dock or no ownership of the dock. We do, again, at the time that I left, Holden had a permit for, I think, 8/10 of an acre down at Lucerne, which included the little waiting chalet,
yes.
Warming chalet, and then also the parking area over by the old hydro plant. And those are the only things that Holden at that time had under permit, but that was a special use permit.
The dock is owned by the Forest Service?
The dock is owned by the Forest Service. We contributed money, both money and also much labor to the construction of the dock, and that's a whole new interesting story, because basically the old dock that was by the Howe Sound Company was removed by the Forest Service without any immediate plans for the replacement. And so the village found itself in a position of trying to operate without any basic access to the village. And we launched a rather extensive, it's really the only time I think that Holden was involved in a wide congressional pressure to get something done. And I still have a notebook that's full of letters from senators, from the vice president. I had written one to the president. Nixon was in office at that time, and it was really an interesting chapter of history of the village. But
you were trying to lobby for what? To get a dock built?
Yeah, because the Forest Service had made no provisions for it, and they told us that they might have money within 5 years to do it, and
without consulting the village in advance,
without
simply took it out.
Right, and it see the originally Howe Sound turned the dock over to Holden, and so Holden really owned that dock, but of course was also responsible for maintaining it then. Well, when the logging company came up there in about 59, they used the dock to unload their logs, and I think because of the maintenance of it, the liability of it, and so forth, they came to the board and said, you know, we'd like to buy the dock, and paid, I think, $3,500 for it, with the verbal agreement that it would go back to the village upon completion of the logging operation, and during the logging operation we would have access to the dock for loading and unloading passengers. Well, it so turned out that at the end of the mining operation, or at the end of the logging operation, the Forest Service put pressure on the logging company to destroy or remove the dock. And again, I think there were some politics involved in that. There was a dock house at Lucerne, right across from where the chalet now is, the waiting chalet, that was owned by the loggers and was actually given to the village too. And the Forest Service, in this same cleanup of Lucerne, required that the logging company burn that and remove it, and it had actually been given to the village. So our property, in that sense, was destroyed.
Mm-hmm. When was the present dock built?
Let's see, the dock was removed, or was burned in 1969, and I think it was 2 years later that we went through one summer without the dock, without any dock. And then the second summer, the dock was sufficiently complete so that it could be be used.
It dates from about 1971.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where the village today represents at peak a community of about 400 people or more, which is basically living in a wilderness area, what are the special problems and challenges that come from that fact?
Well, there's a number of them. I think both for the people who come, maybe not realizing that so many people have come to the village and it's so well known that I think oftentimes people that come there don't realize that they're entering a rather remote area, both from the standpoint of communications as well as access. And so I think it poses some problems to people. Many people that arrive, even the bus trip up to the village becomes a very frightening experience for some of them, and just not ever realizing that, you know, they may have traveled on mountain roads, but not on that particular type of mountain road. And then there are many operational problems. Naturally, the accessibility with everything having to be shipped up by barge or by boat. All the food, all the construction materials, everything that goes into the village has to be shipped in, and there's no road access. We have no communications to order things, which necessitated really to carry enough inventory at the village to take care of minor problems. Not knowing how many people even were going to arrive in the early years, even registration was such that we weren't sure if it was going to be two people arriving or 30 people, and so that there had to be enough flexibility even in the meal preparation to take that in consideration. The whole safety factor of being in an area like that has always been potentially a problem. I think we've been very lucky that very few problems have occurred, but communications, no access to medical help.
There's a nurse in the village.
There's always been a nurse maintained in the village right from, I think, 1961 when the Forerunners came up. There was a nurse with that group, and I think ever since that time there's been a nurse in the village. Oftentimes in the summer there are doctors there that are there in connection with the program, and they're always willing to help out, but the nurse is more or less officially in the village. The village has done a lot, especially in the later years, probably from the early 70s, mid-70s, to update its emergency health care with both equipment and also capabilities, making use of EMTs, making use of people from like the Wenatchee area that would come up to give emergency training. A lot of mountain rescue coordination was done with some of the volunteer organizations in the state. Rescue equipment was upgraded to the village to where at one point we had a very, very good emergency medical and rescue capability, and good coordination with the county sheriff's department, good coordination with like Ballard Ambulance and Wenatchee that provided a lot of assist. So we really had the capability of providing medical help for a great number of people in the Uplake area, including Stehekin, hunters and hikers that were in the area. But it did pose a problem because without the communications, even without you know, the ability to get in emergency transportation, that we were never sure whether we could get emergency transportation in time. I maintained a boat on the lake from 1965 on, primarily for emergency and business travel, and that was used many times to transport people that were injured or sick down lake. Back a number of years, I guess it was about mid-70s, that I also got a ham radio license, amateur radio license, and so that did allow us access to communications that we didn't have prior to that time. So we could actually hook in directly with the hospital in Chelan or with a doctor in Wenatchee and make emergency contacts that way. We tried to predict, you know, emergency necessities and cover ourselves as much as we could, but you just never can predict what's going to happen. And avalanche was another thing that is always a potential risk for the winter at the village. And I went to a number of Forest Service avalanche schools to try to gain some perspective and capability of primarily knowing the dangers, not so much that there's no way to prevent them, but to provide some training for the people that would come into the village in the winter time, because many of these were people that had never been in the mountains during the winter and had no idea of the dangers that existed. And so it was necessary for the village to really train people on the dangers of existing in the wilderness. The other aspect was that we also had to be very aware of how fragile the wilderness was. And being right on the doorstep of the wilderness, so that Holden didn't become a party to, in a sense, overloading the wilderness and ruining the wilderness, which was supposed to be protected for all people. And we worked with the Forest Service a great deal on educational programs, so that the staff members, the guests coming in, would understand what the concept of wilderness was, you know, how fragile it was, even necessity of being quiet in the wilderness for people that wanted a solitary experience, that there was no right for Holden or its staff to go to Lyman Lake and to be boisterous and noisy when somebody from New York may have come in from the other direction and hiked for a couple days to get to Lyman, and they expected solitude and quiet. And we had to help people understand that wasn't our, you know, exclusive domain. And so there again, we were very much guests of the government and all people that owned the wilderness.
And the numbers in the village, especially in the summertime, have been something of a problem in that not everybody can be turned loose on the trails.
Right.
There has to be a limit to the number of people who can go out any one day.
Right. We imposed really more or more strict regulations than the Forest Service had initially, and I'm not sure what has changed in the last couple of years, but we initially, the Forest Service put restrictions on the number of people that could be camping in the wilderness. They never did put restrictions on the number that could be in the wilderness during the day. The Holden put restrictions on that, just as our attempt of maintaining the wilderness area, and so that we had self-imposed restrictions on how many hikers could go to Lyman or to Hart or to Holden. We also encouraged the improvement of the of the Holden Trail between Holden and then Donkey on the...